You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Upon a Star, by Kimberly Drew. The magnet, Taylor Swift's Shake It Off, was in the script, so Nyong'o taught herself to play it on the ukulele, as director Abe Forsyth imagined for the role. She also immersed herself in the minutiae of being a kindergarten teacher, right down to creating lesson plans. I love deep diving into a character I'm playing, says Nyong'o, emphasizing that children posed a particular challenge. I would be so tired at the end of the day working with these kids. They're unpredictable. They've got a lot of energy. It was a doozy, but I loved it. I loved every moment of it. Like Forsyth, director Jordan Peele wrote the mirroring characters of Adelaide and Red specifically for Nyong'o in his thriller Us. Part of her immersive prep work for that film was watching a list of horror films recommended by Peele. They helped me and Jordan establish a shared cinematic language while shooting, says Nyong'o. Lupita is a performer who is able to tap into raw energy and raw emotion. She can delve into some really dark places and do so with complete emotional commitment, as we saw in 12 Years a Slave. And in Us, I knew she was going to play characters that showed two sides of this primal darkness. One bubbling under the surface, and the other bubbling over the surface, says Peele, who says Nyong'o has a Hitchcockian star quality. Lupita, the star, is distinctive and incomparable. There's only one of her. So the notion of seeing two Lupitas on screen at the same time would automatically feel compelling, as well as alien and unnatural. Shortly after she wrapped Black Panther, Nyong'o had somewhat reluctantly begun work on her first book, Sulwe, which comes out this month. The idea came from a speech Nyong'o gave in 2014 at the Essence Black Women in Hollywood brunch about colorism. I received a letter from a girl, Nyong'o said to the audience, and I'd like to share just a small part of it with you. Dear Lupita, it reads, I think you're really lucky to be this black, but yet this successful in Hollywood overnight. I was just about to buy Dencia's Whitenaceous Cream to lighten my skin when you appeared on the world map and saved me. Her words went viral at the time, and shortly came suggestions for a children's book. But, says Nyong'o, I just felt depleted. I was just like, I have nothing more to say. It's all in the speech. With time, and having felt the enormous potential of Black Panther, however, she returned to the idea. Black Panther was the key I needed. The book centers on a little girl named Sulwe, Luo for star, who was bullied for being the color of midnight, an experience that mirrors Nyong'o's own. How could she, as dark as she was, have brightness in her, Sulwe wonders to herself. The child's dreamlike journey to self-discovery is complex and full of nuance, even in child-friendly prose. With illustrations by Vashti Harrison, the book is as beautiful as it is powerful, and it's another book that will serve as the basis for Nyong'o's next project, which she is producing and starring in, the television adaptation of Americana, which Nyong'o's friend Guerrera is adapting. Guerrera worked with Nyong'o on Panther and also wrote the off-Broadway play Eclipsed, in which Nyong'o acted. We're so close to rolling the cameras. It's really exciting to see that kind of labor of love actually come to fruition, says Nyong'o, adding that Guerrera is bringing her tenacious passion and her perspective, her humor, her understanding of the stories and the worlds of Americana. One has to wonder how she's able to keep herself balanced with so many projects. For Nyong'o, there has to be a clear dismount from each project. I found that it's good to have that interim before I return to my quote-unquote normal life. She insists on traveling to distant lands or enrolling in Vipassana meditation retreats. Finishing an intensive project is kind of like having a hangover, where you're so used to a rigor of existence, then all of a sudden, there's none, she says. I make the time because otherwise I wouldn't survive. She also commands herself and those in her inner circle to embrace a sense of spontaneity. Back to that sky blue Prada on that all-important career-altering evening in 2014, or rather the day before. Nyong'o's publicist thought a dress rehearsal could help ease everyone's jitters. For most red carpet events, Nyong'o's stylist, Michaela Erlanger, chooses a look. And then Vernon Francois and Nick Burrows will work with Nyong'o on, respectively, the hair and makeup. But a dress rehearsal just felt too forced, maybe even a jinx. To give me that kind of grandeur, says Nyong'o, would be crippling for me. And so, the morning of the Oscars ceremony, Nyong'o's team walked in to dress her for the first time, the big time, but they were all a bundle of nerves. Nyong'o says she was blissed out from a massage that Alfre Woodard had gifted to her, but her team was shaking. They were physically shaking. They were so nervous. So Nyong'o turned on the stereo and blasted Grown Woman. Beyonce did the trick. We danced it off, we had a good laugh, and then we sat down. You've got to let the oxygen in, Nyong'o says. I believe in enjoying the moment. It's about the moment. Secrets and Lies by Vanessa Grigoriadis. Opening illustration of the subject by Philip Burke. Dating the Monster. In rarefied New York circles, Jeffrey Epstein was the sociopath who proved the rule. Many moons ago, in the early 2000s, my friends spent a weekend in Southampton with a distinctive young blonde who resembled Lady Gaga, if Gaga were British. She was about 22 and said she was an interior designer, or a jewelry designer, or a motivational coach. I can't remember which, but in any case, the job sounded semi-fake, and she lived in an apartment on the Upper East Side that her older boyfriend had given her, at least temporarily. He collected art, and they often attended auctions. He loved vegetarian food and playing unfamiliar concertos on his grand piano. As she strolled down Southampton's tree-lined streets, she was struck by their beauty and said she'd have to discuss getting a home there with her boyfriend. His name was Jeffrey Epstein. Back then, as a cocky, petite, ink-stained wretch, I wasn't one of the young women in Manhattan whom Epstein and his friends approached for relationships, one-night stands, or abuse, but I was surrounded by a lot of them. They were always the most beautiful girls in the room, usually models or former models, with a slightly aloof Stepford Wives aura that masked a deeper vulnerability. Several names came up when they were around: Epstein, supermarket magnate Ron Burkle, film financier Steve Bing, and former President Bill Clinton. Then, in the prime of his post-presidential career and flying around on Epstein's jet, dubbed the Lolita Express, or Burkle's jet, dubbed the Air F1. Clinton has not been accused of wrongdoing. The women were often blonde. Epstein, in particular, liked patrician blondes with a bit of a baby face. At his home on the Upper East Side, he kept a photo of 80s soap star Morgan Fairchild, whom he called his ideal woman, though considering they were both in their early 50s back then, she was far too old for him. Beyond allegedly running a pedophile ring, Epstein, who hanged himself in August, epitomized the transactional nature of fin de siècle New York society, the sociopath who proved the rule. As hedge funds began to create massive fortunes and the billionaire class outpaced entail and primogeniture, women like the one in Southampton were necessary accessories, and learning how to acquire them was part of many a high-level trader's skill set. There's a temptation to say that the world has always worked this way. Ambitious, beautiful young women have often sought to climb rungs via powerful men, and powerful men have partly craved power in order to access beautiful women. But this era in New York was unique. A rapidly increasing workforce of women in black slip dresses, knee-high black boots, and flat-ironed hair had come to seek the sex and the city lifestyle, not husbands, but with most of their professions, fashion, publicity, publishing, paying far less than men's, they were not averse to someone footing the bill. Beautiful women also had currency in the city's models and bottles scene, as the post-9/11 era of downtown nightlife was called. Manhattan's legendary club scene of hip-hop stars, painters, and graffiti artists, where one gained entree by virtue of one's art rather than the size of one's wallet, was going capitalist. A new nightclub formula had been devised. ice buckets of Cristal and Chirac bottles were set up at leather banquettes, alongside every kind of model, Victoria's Secret model, runway model, supermodel, just-off-the-boat model. And if you were a rich, older guy who wanted to take a seat, it could cost up to $10,000, though Puffy and Leo didn't pay a thing. Like his billionaire friends, Epstein ran a highly compartmentalized life. He'd say he was going somewhere for work, and then I'd see pictures in a British tabloid of him on a yacht with supermodels, says a woman who dated one of his close friends. The women of consenting age with whom Epstein became involved weren't gold diggers, per se. They were models, or Amy Winehouse's Gucci bag crew flying to Miami for free, or post-collegiate women who didn't care about a 30-year age difference. Some wanted to open a door to the world of private planes and the global elite. In later years, he favored a different kind of Eastern European woman who was more expressly for sale. There are almost as many people involved over 18 as under 18. It's not 50-50, but it's in that ballpark, says David Boies, the attorney for some of Epstein's accusers. He describes two different types of age women involved with Epstein. There were women who were not underage, but usually in their younger 20s, who became part of what we're calling Epstein's sex trafficking orbit. They'd either be trafficked or let out, describe it as you will, to other people, he says. Then there were young professional women of comparable age, whom Epstein sort of dated, and then he might or might not recommend them to other people. Young women like the one I came across in Southampton were presumably part of that second set. She did not return messages for further comment. Epstein's recommendations for these young women were romantic or professional or some uneasy mix of both. Charlie Rose, disgraced after sexual assault allegations, received suggestions for several assistants on his TV show from Epstein. The women who dated Epstein, many of whom now have high-profile careers, didn't want to be identified in this article. Some, because they feel the press would mangle their relationships and describe them as prostitutes. Not a reputation a professional woman can surmount. Some were getting something from Epstein. A trip on a private plane with Bill Clinton is not without value. But more often they were, to some degree, the commodities, tradable objects. That was part of the grift. Epstein traded men for acceptance, always trying to show other men how many important people he knew, politicians, billionaires, former Harvard president Larry Summers, top scientist. Women were another instrumentality. Everyone had their price. Epstein's ex-girlfriends say he was quiet and charming, for the most part. Jay Gatsby in a monogrammed sweatshirt. He spent most of the day on speakerphone, and he liked them to listen in. Rolling calls from financiers to heads of state. He did not drink or take drugs or smoke, and he didn't like to be around people who did. He practiced Iyengar yoga. He showered many times a day. He abhorred restaurants and ate whole grains, proteins, and leafy greens 30 years before the rest of America. He tied body to mind, physical self to mental aptitude. He believed in transhumanism and had a theory that if you had too much muscle mass, you wouldn't be as smart as you could be. He liked to sleep in 54-degree chill because he believed you'd get the most restful sleep at that temperature. I was like, I'm effing freezing. I'm going to die of hypothermia, says an ex-girlfriend. He also had an instinct for what people wanted. Jeffrey was brilliant in understanding how people felt, says the same ex-girlfriend. He could feel energy very clearly, but I think because he's a sociopath, he would manipulate that for his own needs. The average human population just doesn't operate that way, and thank God. The man who contributed to Epstein's riches, Les Wexner, the owner of Victoria's Secret, and the richest man in Ohio for whom Epstein managed money and had some sort of deep emotional relationship, seemed as ill at ease as Epstein was forthright. Women who dined with Wexner found him awkward and without the gift of gab, which Epstein had in spades. A Sports Illustrated model says that in the 1990s, Epstein sent her as a lark to deliver Wexner's prenup at his office. The rumor was she went to Wexner's office, lay down on the table, and had him sign the prenup on her belly, but she says this isn't true. Jeffrey told me to wear something sexy and that it would be a great practical joke. But when I got there, it was very uncomfortable, and Les was like, "What are you doing here? Okay, I'll sign, and then you should go." The longer these women dated Epstein, the stranger he became. A former girlfriend describes him as almost agoraphobic, with a fear of groups and a dislike of shaking people's hands. He preferred one-on-one relationships, which were more conducive to sharing secrets. Other than the trips he took on his private plane, Epstein preferred to socialize at home, where he could control the food, the conversation, the temperature. In Manhattan, he lived in a $56 million townhouse that once housed the Birch Wathen Prep School, with his initials emblazoned next to the door, and he hired a white-gloved butler to serve high tea. But underneath this pose lurked someone quite different. He was so insecure. He had that outer borough thing of always needing a model on his arm, says the Sports Illustrated model. He was emotionally infantile, stunted, without an inner world. She describes Epstein watching her brush her hair and asking, "Do you use a Mason Pearson brush? The expensive brush favored by stylists in the fashion industry?" She said yes, and he responded excitedly that he did too. He said, "Oh yes, they're the best." He was like a little boy who got his cool toy, and then he'd collect people just like that hairbrush. It was so odd. Epstein was always talking about how well-connected he was. He was a total star effer, says a woman in his orbit. In his secret life, he was grotesque, but in society, he was thought of as a practical joker who enjoyed messing with those he regarded as lower on the food chain. The Sports Illustrated model describes meeting Donald Trump at one of Trump's parties in the penthouse of the Plaza Hotel back then. Trump goaded Epstein for her number. "Jeffrey said he wouldn't give it to him, and he had to get it from me," she says. She finally gave it to him on another occasion, but he lost it. Trump called Jeffrey trying to get it again, saying, "She gave it to me. You know she gave it to me. You can give it to me now." But Jeffrey wouldn't do it. She laughs. "Donald was such a joke to all of the models back then. We all knew he was bankrupt and had no game. I remember Jeffrey once saying he was going to be late to pick me up because he had to drop off food for Donald. He was at home crying under the covers." Epstein always had a story to tell, even about his home. He was obsessed with jewelry boxes and very detailed, ornate designs. He told me the Pope actually gave him artisans who teamed up with this one jewelry box maker from Paris to make his dining room look like a giant version of the inside of a Parisian jewelry box, says an ex-girlfriend. Epstein also said that his friend Lynn Forrester, now married to billionaire Evelyn de Rothschild, needed his financial help during her 1990s divorce from politician Andrew Stein, and that he had graciously floated her. 100% false, says a spokesperson for Forrester. He claimed that the producers of The Apprentice had first approached him to make a show about a reclusive billionaire living an extravagant life. But he said no, and then introduced them to Trump. A spokesperson for Mark Burnett denies this. Epstein liked having secrets and enjoyed the way those secrets kept people off balance. He always wanted to give the impression that he was an international man of mystery. I control everyone and everything. I collect people. I own people. I can damage people, says an ex-girlfriend. One of the most mysterious parts of his life was his relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell, the favorite daughter of embezzling British press baron and rumored Mossad spy Robert Maxwell, who died when he fell, or was pushed, from his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine. Epstein told them the raven-haired A-lister Maxwell, who opened her Rolodex for him, was a former girlfriend who had fallen on hard times, and he had taken it upon himself to maintain her position in society. Young women have since alleged that she was both part of the sex trafficking ring, bringing underage girls to Epstein, and a sexual participant. Ghislaine floated in and out of the house with the keys, and even though Jeffrey told me they didn't have a sexual relationship, she'd drop under her breath that she was sleeping in his bed from time to time, says an ex-girlfriend. A friend of Maxwell's says she used to joke about keeping herself rail thin. Because Epstein liked thin girls. She said, I do it the way Nazis did it with the Jews, the Auschwitz diet. I just don't eat. Next photo, Epstein with Ghislaine Maxwell. On the weekends in the 1990s, Maxwell would have her rollerblades FedExed to Jeffrey's Island in the Caribbean, and she said that she got her helicopter pilot's license so she could transport anyone she liked on her rig, Air Ghislaine II, without pilots knowing who they were. Maxwell also said the island had been wired for video. The friend thought that she and Epstein were videotaping everyone on the island as an insurance policy, as blackmail. A source close to Maxwell says she spoke glibly and confidently about getting girls to sexually service Epstein, saying this was simply what he wanted, and describing the way she'd drive around to spas in Florida to recruit them. She would claim she had a phone job for them, and you'll make lots of money, meet everyone, and I'll change your life. The source continues, Ghislaine was in love with Jeffrey the way she was in love with her father. She always thought if she just did one more thing for him to please him, he would marry her. Maxwell also told this woman about the young girls in Epstein's life. She said, they're nothing, these girls. They are trash. Epstein's perversions have revealed much more than one man's sinister nature. He had a sprawling network of friends and acquaintances who may have participated in or simply overlooked his crimes. These women, however, say he saw himself as a savior of women, including Maxwell, and initiating them into his alternative lifestyle as a path forward in their lives. One night, after we were dating for 6 or 7 months, he sat me down and presented what he wanted for a formal relationship going forward, says one woman. He told her he had a very high sex drive and, like many rich men, dated several women at a time. This was the way of kings and queens. It was all about how, if I was less conventional and pedestrian, I could have this relationship with him. It was a whole spiel about polyamory, and it made me really insecure. I wasn't a girl who had high self-esteem or self-worth at that time. I didn't think I could do an open relationship, and I also thought if I said I wouldn't do it, he would still go out with me, but he didn't. Soon she started to receive strange messages nearly every week. They had pictures of her in them as she was going about her life. I didn't think that meant Jeffrey was pining for me and his life was ruined, she says. I just knew he had legions of people around him to do things like that. Another woman who dated Epstein says he slept with a gun and a holster on the side of the bed and was always playing spy games, as she calls it. She thinks he tapped her phone after they broke up. She came home to her doorman saying he'd let a repairman in to fix her cable, even though she hadn't requested service. Then I had a weird sensation when I was talking to Jeffrey. He kept looking me in the eye in a creepy way and quoting something I'd said about him earlier on the phone to a girlfriend, she says. I threw the phone out and cut off all contact with him. These women weren't as powerless as the teenagers in Palm Beach, Florida, whom Epstein was paying a couple $100 for massages that turned into sex. Nor were they sex slaves, and they largely weren't afraid of Epstein back then. But his death has freaked them out. Before he hanged himself, one of them told me, I think Jeffrey will either get sentenced to prison for life, or if he's in prison with all the people who don't want him to reveal his secrets, he's dead anyway. This article incorporates materials from WebPost published on July 18th and August 12th. Thank you. Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit, October 21st through the 23rd, 2019, Los Angeles Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. Newsmaking insights, unforgettable parties, invaluable connections. Confirmed speakers, Gwyneth Paltrow, Bob Iger, Sheryl Sandberg, Hasan Minhaj, Natalie Massenet, Jon Favreau, Lena Waithe, Brian Armstrong, Ted Sarandos, Edward Norton, John Foley, Melina Matsoukas, Marlon James. To learn more about the summit schedule, other speakers, and to request an invitation, visit vfsummit.com. Presenting sponsor, BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Thank you. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. David Chang. The Momofuku chef, founder, and host of Netflix's docuseries Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner, Chews on Karma, Patience, and Dance Lessons. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Good TV, good delivery, perfect AC, literally doing nothing. What is your greatest fear? Figuratively doing nothing. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Admiral Yi Sun Sin. Which living person do you most admire? My wife, Grace. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My intense self-loathing. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Unwillingness to change. What is your greatest extravagance? Saltwater fly fishing, finding the most remote places to fish, and the time to go. What is your favorite journey? Being a dad for the first time. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Patience. On what occasion do you lie? When I tell myself or others that I'm going to work out. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My head is too big. It's an inconvenience. Which living person do you most despise? Donald Trump. If your answer is not Donald Trump, you've answered this incorrectly. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? If and shit and effing shit. What is your greatest regret? Not doing better in school and not taking advantage of what I could have learned there, very closely followed by never learning to dance. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Work was my first love, but thankfully it's been replaced by my wife and son. When and where were you happiest? Knicks versus Lakers at Madison Square Garden during Linsanity. Which talent would you most like to have? I wish I was great at basketball. Basically, I wish I had the talent to be an Asian Zion Williamson. What is your current state of mind? Shit never gets easier. It just keeps getting harder and weirder. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Learning to appreciate what I have. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish that immigrating to the States had been easier on my parents. What do you consider your greatest achievement? I'm still here. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Karma's going to make sure I come back as a lobster. I've cooked too many. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Bob Dylan. What is your most treasured possession? My passport. Having lost three, I know it's a nightmare to replace. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Sitting at a desk job heading toward mediocrity. Where would you like to live? Wherever the weather suits my clothes. What is your favorite occupation? Wrought iron worker or a blacksmith? Jobs that will never be cool. What is your most marked characteristic? Unfortunately, a quick temper and a foul mouth. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty. Who are your favorite writers? David Foster Wallace, Ray Monk, David Halberstam, K. Redfield Jameson, Anthony Bourdain. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Sisyphus. Who are your heroes in real life? My mom. What are your favorite names? Aloysius. What is it that you most dislike? Formal wear and occasions that require it. How would you like to die? Doing something heroic. What is your motto? Save something for the swim back. the Vanity Fair Best Dressed list. In a year in which Camp was queen and some 89 congresswomen showed their might in suffragette white, we salute the standouts who made us look, time and again, in style so remarkable, so personal, so flat-out fabulous, that we are reminded clothes are never really just clothes. Interviews by Maggie Bullock. Photograph by Gillian Laub of Marc Jacobs, who makes the 2019 Best Dressed list in the category of the virtuosos. Marc Jacobs, occupation, fashion designer, home base, New York City. Happiest wearing custom patent leather boots by Alessandro Michele and a suit designed and cut perfectly by Ralph Fitzgerald, the New York City-based tailor for Savile Row's Huntsman, to marry my husband, Char, this year. Current obsession, nail art. May Kawajiri paints each nail by hand, pure talent and passion. In this photo, Jacobs wears his own Gucci suit, which is royal blue. The jacket is double-breasted with gold buttons. Boots and scarf. And the scarf is red with royal blue print. And the boots are a rather honey-colored leather, which almost matches the gold buttons. Sunglasses by Loewy, and these sunglasses are a coordinating royal blue to match the suit. Hair products by R & Company. Grooming products by Marc Jacobs Beauty. Serge Ibaka, occupation, Toronto Raptors, center, forward, home base, Toronto, Barcelona, New York City. Happiest wearing custom suits during playoffs, just walking into the arena with confidence. Style icon, my dad. Current obsession, Nick Bouquet chapeau, a nice hat can be very powerful. Trend I despise, big logos, just to show you wear expensive clothes. Favorite designers, Valentino, Balmain. And here he wears two outfits. One is a very interesting looking Southwest print cape jacket with a hoodie and black pants, black shoes. Next outfit, he absolutely rocks a white kilt, white jacket, white shirt, has on black Doc Marten style boots, black and white striped socks, and sunglasses. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. Both parts A and B of Vanity Fair are available as a podcast.